Welcome to We Mentor Mondays with Nancy podcast program. Get inspired. Break through to new dimensions with your peers on the entrepreneurial journey of self-discovery, leadership revolution, and life success. Learn something new from our mentoring conversation today. Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in this week. Say we've got a third session here with Suzula Bidone, and we would like to talk about terminology. Let me just introduce a little bit about her background to refresh your memory. So Suzula is a recovery advocate, attorney, yoga teacher, and Minnesota certified peer recovery specialist. She developed her recovery yoga meetings curriculum as a facet of her own recovery and has been leading recovery yoga meetings since 2012. I will include her past two episodes so you can get up to speed on her background. And we're going to jump right into some terminology that I had learned at a presentation that we were at in January of 2018. So Suzula presented at the Minnesota Continuing Legal Education Conference. She co-presented with Elizabeth Wittenberg. The title of her presentation was Breaking Stigma, Creating Awareness, Safety, and Understanding for Seeking Help. And so we thought that we would like to bring to you what she's learned about the language that we use and how we can break some of the stigma around addiction.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Go for it.
Thank you, Nancy. So one of the At the Continuing Legal Education seminar, one of the main parts of my presentation was just five simple things, or maybe not simple, five things that we can all do in terms of changing our language that can help to change stigma and the perception in society of people with addiction. So the first one is stigma itself. So the term stigma is just the politically correct term for discrimination. You know, if you think back 20, 30 years ago, someone would call someone a retard if they were mentally retarded, or, I won't go through a bunch of other examples, but, you know, in the past, that would have been acceptable. And it is, you know, people with substance use disorder, people recovering from addictions and mental health issues, they have disabilities. They're protected under the Americans with Disabilities Act. And so it's not, you know, it doesn't serve us to continue to talk about stigma. You know, we don't want to stigmatize people. It's discrimination. If someone is in recovery from addiction and they've remade their life and you hold that against them, that they used to have trouble with substances, that's discrimination. That's not stigma. So we need to be really clear about that.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the second one is the term addiction itself. With the new DSM-5, so the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which includes all of the psychiatric diagnoses, addiction is a spectrum. It's substance use disorder. And so, you know, people fall all along that spectrum. My particular pet peeve is when people talk about substance abuse disorder. It's not, it's substance use disorder. Because when you think about it, there are plenty of people who, just to make the easy example, who drink alcohol without a problem. Yeah. So in that instance, for someone who abuses alcohol, it's alcohol use disorder, not alcohol abuse disorder, because it's possible to use alcohol without it being a problem. And so it's substance use disorder, first of all, and addiction is at the far end of that spectrum. And so—
Oh, I see.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so just roping all, or, you know, grouping everyone who might have problems with substances or substance abuse into that addiction category is not accurate. It's substance use disorder. And also with that as well is, what do we call people with substance use disorder? And here's just a little historical background. So, you know, 78 years ago now, I think it was, when Alcoholics Anonymous, the first 12-step mutual aid group was formed, you know, addiction was thought of as a moral failing. Alcoholism was thought of as a moral failing. It was about willpower and weakness. And so the medical establishment didn't know what to do. And so what people did to support each other in recovery is they would get together in these meetings and introduced themselves as, "Hello, I'm Sazula. I'm an alcoholic." And the reason for that was to admit that they had a problem and to identify with each other as having the same problem. That's wonderful. I have been a member of 12-step groups. It's a wonderful option for people healing from substance use disorder. And we're 75, 78 years later. We understand a lot more about substance use disorder. It is a biological condition. It's a brain disorder. There's chemistry in the brain that changes. And so it's just further reinforcing stigma to continue calling people addicts and alcoholics. I believe it was Faces and Voices, which is a recovery organization that did a study and found that when it comes to the perception of people with substance use disorder, simply saying a person with substance use disorder rather than an addict or an alcoholic changes the perception of people simply by saying a person with substance use disorder.
Yeah.
You know, someone with depression, you wouldn't call them a depressive. You'd call them a person with depression.
When I was, I was a special education teacher. I had received a master's in that area, and I was working in a residential treatment center with kids. And it was during the 80s when there was over-medication going on with kids. And also we were talking about the language that we're using with kids. So it's not you have a disability. It's this student is struggling with a disability.
Yes.
Or they're having a behavioral issue, or they're experiencing attention deficit hyperactivity disorder.
Yes.
But you put the person first before the title.
Yeah.
Before the tagline.
Exactly. Which, you know, it seems so politically correct and everything, and yet it's drastically needed because the perception of people with substance use disorder is still, you know, still really unfair. And it just feeds into that stigma and discrimination. So, yes.
Well, and you've experienced, too, in the legal system as well. So I've seen it, and some parents see it, their kids going through special education programs where their kids are pigeonholed in a particular area and they can't really outlive the label.
Yes, yes.
And so all their education is funneled through to them in a specific way. But the programs have evolved. And so children with different disabilities, they're actually integrated more into the classrooms instead of pulling them out unless they need to for a specific area to really grasp more. But during the 90s, there was a big concerted effort to get all kids, even to an extreme degree, into classrooms full time. And so, yeah, like you're talking about as you're defining the five different areas of where we need to understand this particular population, that the stigma is really important to know, and also how we're identifying with naming people.
Right. So basically, it's not stigma, that's soft pedaling it. It's discrimination, and I am not an addict. I'm a person in recovery from substance use disorder, and
that's what needs to change.
Right. Yep. Those are the first two.
Yep.
The third is, this is a little more technical, but it applies to everyone. So people in recovery, especially from drugs, people will often say, oh, that person is clean or that person is dirty, right? Meaning that person is either using substances or not. And in particular, in the legal system, when urinalysis or drug testing is done, you could see where that would make sense. Well, their urine was clean of substances or their urine was dirty. But I mean, think about it. Does anyone want to be called clean or dirty? No, it's pejorative. And so it's another area where we need to be mindful of talking about, rather than someone, oh, they're clean, or, you know, we can say they're in recovery, they're sober, they're abstinent.
You know, they use that same terminology in sports when they do the testing for the Olympics with the whether they're using drugs or not, whether their urine tested clean or dirty.
Right.
So what's a different way they could word that?
So,
or what's a better way of saying that?
So with the drug testing, for instance, their test came back negative for the presence of substances, came back positive for the presence of substances. Again, it's that crucial separating part of it is that separating of the person from the disease or the person from the problem.
I see. So changing language is actually helping a person to claim their humanity.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Got
mm-hmm.
it. All right. Yep. The fourth one?
So the fourth one is medication-assisted treatment, which I spoke about in one of our earlier talks. And I just like to introduce this. So people hear, you know, with the opioid crisis, they hear, you know, medication-assisted treatment, and they think Suboxone or methadone, you know, these medications to help with opioid use disorder. But I'd like to just take it back a step. So if someone is addicted to smoking cigarettes and they put a patch on, or they take one of the medications you can take, or they chew the nicotine gum, mm-hmm. that is medication-assisted treatment. That is using nicotine in a different form that doesn't have all the negatives. You don't have to buy the cigarettes. You don't have to smoke with all those toxic chemicals. And it gets you out of the habit of putting a cigarette to your mouth every X amount of time. You still get the nicotine that helps control the anxiety and the cravings and all that, but you're able to change your behavior, change your habits. And once yeah. you've done that, then if it's appropriate, you can wean off of the nicotine, patch, gum, whatever it is.
So instead of doing such extremes,
right,
going from all a drug, you know, taking drugs to nothing at all, you know, there's an avenue that you're saying needs to happen, a road between the two.
Well, and we know this because we know that substance use disorder is a brain disorder, and there's an adaptation of the brain
that needs to happen.
That happens with addiction or with, you know, repeated substance abuse. And so just stopping the drug doesn't stop that change in the brain. You have to rewire that change. And so part of the way to do that is by, again, you know, changing your habits, changing your behavior. Not to go down a rabbit hole, but part of it is, you know, you lose the ability to obtain pleasure from normal things. I mean, food, social interaction, sex, those kind of things that would normally give you pleasure.
Yeah.
When you've been abusing drugs, your pleasure system, the dopamine, all of those things in your brain are out of whack. And so if you stop using drugs, you don't have that same ability to get pleasure from normal things. But if you're able to rebuild your life and start to have meaningful social interactions and have those things, again, speaking from experience, my own experience, when I was able to rebuild my life and cultivate those normal pleasures, those normal activities, then I was able to have that once I tapered down off of the medication that was assisting my treatment.
Wow. Yeah, I see that. Okay.
So, and then number five is, let me think, what's number five? I think we're on number five, aren't we? Is medication-assisted treatment? Yeah, I think what it was is that, you know, the stigma versus discrimination, the, you know, addiction versus substance use disorder, addict versus a person with substance use disorder. So those are two separate things.
Oh, that okay.
Right.
If they're two separate things, then you've got all five.
Yep.
Yeah, that's what makes sense. Okay, then getting rid of the clean or dirty to positive and negative, and then the medicated assisted treatment.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Really awesome recommendations. I think that all leaders can start tomorrow, even later today, with kind of making the list of the five and kind of making sure that they're not, if they've got people they're working with mm-hmm. or if they have people in their lives mm-hmm. that are experiencing addiction, that they start changing how they're approaching that too.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe they have already because it's such a human experience.
Right.
So what's your relationship with your mom like now? I know, totally off topic, but I just kept thinking about your mom. Yeah,
my relationship with my mom is great. She lives here in the same area that I do. And
how did you repair your relationship with her? Was she one of the first people you repaired your relationship with, or how did you approach that?
We always had a relationship in terms of we always were in contact, and she was always supportive. I think she just had to take steps at certain points to protect herself with, you know, tough love, quote unquote, of, you know, drawing boundaries where, you know, not letting me live with her because I was actively using those kind of things. And so—
Did you feel that so you understood that?
Oh, at the time, no. Of course not. But now, in hindsight, I do.
And you think that maybe saved your relationship, or did that help you to on your path to owning your own pain?
I just understand it in retrospect, and I understand it, you know, in my own life today. If I have people that do things in my life that I don't approve of or that I can't, you know, then I have to set those boundaries. And so I understand why she did that. And I mean, I wouldn't say that it was part of what helped us heal our relationship necessarily, but, you know, a big part of what helped was her really understanding that addiction is not a choice. You know, I mean, for a long time, she thought, what is wrong with my daughter? Why is she doing this? Why is she throwing her life away? Why? And it was in family week at my final inpatient treatment that worked in 2008, where she learned about addiction and the neurobiology of it. And that, you know, there's, you know, you can be predisposed based on, you know, it's 40 to 70% genetic, like I was saying from the Surgeon General's report, and how trauma and, you know, trauma really leads to decreased resilience to stress, which then leads to, you know, increased seeking of things to help deal with stress, like drugs. And so all of these things that helped her understand that it wasn't a choice I was making out of spite or out of weakness. It was something that developed over the course of my life. And once she understood that, she was able to let go of all the personal pain that I had somehow done all of that to hurt her.
Yeah, which I think that's such a hard, I mean, that's the place a person needs to get with anybody in any relationship, mm-hmm. where if you're in pain with them,
mm-hmm.
I've had a very severed family.
Mm-hmm.
And it's taken a lot of time to separate out the person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Or recently, I heard learned the term the personality. So the personality that's causing you harm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I look at it as this is a personality,
right.
of someone that's causing me harm,
mm-hmm.
that then I can change the relationship and the behavior,
mm-hmm.
to protect myself, because that personality is not able to do that.
Right, right.
So that's why you need to, you know, set the stronger, mm-hmm. boundaries.
Right.
Because the other person isn't capable of doing it. Because,
mm-hmm.
if they were, they would.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's not easy to sort out, but it's worth it.
Mm-hmm.
Because you do have to sort out, is it the, you know, what about this relationship isn't working?
Mm-hmm.
And where are the boundaries being breached,
mm-hmm.
where I'm feeling like I'm losing myself with this other person,
right.
or, you know, mm-hmm. or I'm going down the tank with them.
Right.
Which,
right.
I could see as a parent and a mom, mm-hmm. that, you know, you feel so connected emotionally with your child.
Yeah.
And it's so hard to watch,
mm-hmm.
another person, of how important it was that she did set the boundaries.
Yeah, absolutely.
And how you both found, you know, a way to interact in which you weren't causing each other more pain,
mm-hmm.
but also it was so important for your mom to do the work,
mm-hmm.
to not blame you.
Right.
For she needed to take care of herself too.
Yep.
So it was a journey for both of you.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Ongoing. Okay. Well, is there anything else? It seems like we've gotten everything out on the table pretty much.
Oh, there's plenty more, but that's enough. That's enough.
Yeah. That's plenty for our listeners. A lot to think about. And this reinforces how important right mindset,
mm-hmm.
and right speech.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right? In yoga, mm-hmm. we learn the Eightfold Path, and one,
right.
of them is the right speech. So taking a look at how you're using your language and how you're speaking with people.
Yes.
And labeling has been a way in which we've severed the ties between other people and ourselves, so, mm-hmm. that we don't have to deal with their pain.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. Because it's reflected back to us, and, mm-hmm. then we have to deal with our own pain.
Yes.
And that's not always so great.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Plenty of learning today. Well, everybody, take this advice and kind of implement it in your life in the way that it makes the most sense.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks again, Suzula, for being here. You've been a wonderful guest and very insightful in a beautiful spirit.
Oh, well, thank you, Nancy.
Yes, keep on your life purpose.
Thank you.
Like we're all trying to do.
Yes, yes.
And Mike Cabea, sound engineer, photographer, videographer, brother from another mother, stay tuned, stay with us, and enjoy the pictures and all this beautiful what you hear in this podcast every week is from Mike's careful editing. And so thank you for that. And his piano playing at the beginning and end and in the middle of a show. So I just wanted to acknowledge you for the gifts that you're bringing to the program. And thank you for all our listeners, especially those who are listening every week. I'm starting to hear from you and I really enjoy it. Thank you. And I'll keep bringing good stuff to you. See you next Monday.